Good afternoon, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. May it please the court. I'm Rick Miller from the firm of Ferry, Joseph & Pierce, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellant, the petitioner below, Elizabeth Dowland. I have reserved 5 minutes for my rebuttal. This is a petition for reformation of the last will and testament of Benjamin Dowland. My client, Elizabeth Dowland, is the decedent's surviving spouse. The decedent had powers of appointment over two trusts that were created by his parents. He told the scrivener of his last will and testament.
That would be a lawyer, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. He told her that he wanted to exercise those powers of appointment in favor of my client, giving her an income interest in those two trusts, and in favor of his grandson, Benjamin Dowland, to receive the principal of those trusts when my client passes. The scrivener prepared a will for the decedent which omitted language necessary to exercise those powers of appointment that he held.
Wouldn't that give rise to a claim against the attorney?
It may, Your Honor. That is absolutely the case, that it could lead to a legal malpractice claim. However,
I'm raising that not because I'm looking to encourage litigation, but rather because I understand your position to be that the court should change the law and adopt a new approach that would allow reformation of wills. And as everybody knows, wills have always been put in a special category for the simple reason that the decedent is no longer there to explain his or her actual desires. So rather than having the court undertake a new approach to the law, wouldn't it be better, considering that there is an alternative, to pursue this claim against the scrivener?
Well, first I would point out, Your Honor, that a legal malpractice claim is also available in case of scrivener error in an ordinary contract situation or a trust situation or any other type of situation where an attorney is preparing an instrument for a client that does not reflect the client's intent. So that legal remedy is available in other situations in which equity will step in and reform those documents, even with that possibility of the legal malpractice action being out there. But I would also answer Your Honor's question by saying we do not believe that in this case a legal malpractice action constitutes an adequate remedy at law. And we believe that for two reasons. First of all, it does not address the decedent's intent. The decedent's intent here was to pass along trusts that were prepared by his parents. These trusts are a family legacy, and he had the ability to appoint this family legacy to persons that he wanted to appoint them to. He chose my client and his grandson, the respondent's son. And if we are going to adhere to the decedent's intent, we should acknowledge his intent and enforce it. But secondarily, Your Honor, the availability of a legal malpractice claim also does not cure a second goal of equity, which is to prevent unjust enrichment. Sure, my client could possibly have an action against the scrivener that could be subject to a number of legal defenses for such as contributory negligence or some other factors that would not be available in a reformation action. But when she recovers, if she recovers a legal malpractice claim, that recovery is coming out of either the lawyer's own pocket or malpractice insurance, one or the other.
Does the record reflect the value of the assets which would be subject to the power of appointment?
It doesn't at this stage, Your Honor. I mean, the best I can tell you is at the last I saw, it was around $500,000. If Mr. Burrell has more information about that, I'm sure he could fill you in. I apologize. I don't have that information available at this point. The value has gone down a little bit recently because of market issues, which affects a lot of us, unfortunately.
Are these stocks or is it real estate? What?
I believe that it's mostly securities, that the trust is primarily invested in securities of different types. I believe that it's a conservative investment, but it has lost value from what I understand. In any event, the Court of Chancery assumed the facts in the record most favorable to my client. So the Court of Chancery assumed that the Scrivener's error occurred and that the Scrivener's error was the proximate cause of the reason why this language was not inserted in the will.
It also assumes, does it not, the fact, which is normally disputed in these types of cases, that is, it assumes the perfect fact that there's no dispute that the testator intended for the result to be as you argued, and that result would have occurred but for the Scrivener's error here. Therefore, if there were ever a perfect case, I mean, I'm just making the argument and asking if there's, if I've got it right or not. If there is such a thing as a perfect case for reforming a will, this is it. Therefore, equity, should not let this wrong go without a remedy.
Certainly my client believes that's the case, Your Honor.
Are you arguing that that's the case?
Absolutely.
And the record supports the notion that no one disputes that the result here was inconsistent with what the testator wanted?
Well, I think Mr. Burrell will probably stand up and dispute it, Your Honor, but the fact of the matter is that that's what the Scrivener testified to in her deposition, and her contemporaneous notes also show that the decedent's intent was to have these trusts go to my client and his grandson. And there's one other salient fact, I believe, which is very important here. The will does contain a startling evidence of the testator's intent when he specifically excludes the respondent from his estate. He says he doesn't want the respondent to get anything.
Well, before we go further down that path, following up on Justice Berger's question, is there any evidence to contravene that disputes your side of the case, which is that the intent of the testator here is clear?
When I deposed the respondent, he admitted that he had no knowledge of his father's estate plan, and he admitted that they had no kind of like reconciliation or anything like that.
Well, I'm not asking you. I'm just asking you if there's any evidence to controvert your side of the case.
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I could. I think I know what Mr. Burrell's response is going to be. He's going to say, "Well, Mr. the decedent read the will before he signed it, so he must have agreed with its contents." And I think that is typically the response that you get in a reformation type action. And yet the cases are pretty clear that the remedy for reformation will exist even where the parties have read the documents.
Because so you're saying, if I understand you properly, that there's an inference, an adverse inference that might be drawn from the fact that the testator read the will before signing it with the error.
Well, I mean, we're really digging deep into the factual record now, Your Honor, but I'm sure that's what Mr. Burrell would argue, yes.
Yeah, all right. Well, I understand that. And is there anything else?
I'm not aware of any other evidence that supports the argument that the omission of this language was anything but Scrivener error.
In terms of accepting the view of the restatement third, the states that have done that are what? Indiana, at least in context of trusts, and New York, sort of in anticipation of it?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Indiana certainly has looked at the restatement section in the context of a testamentary trust and has decided that it's worthwhile adopting the concepts of it. And
but in Indiana, at least, there was also a statute, wasn't there?
I believe there was.
And are there four or are there more states that have rejected the restatement? I have a count of Massachusetts, Maryland, Texas, and Minnesota.
To be honest with you, Your Honor, the only one that I'm aware of is Massachusetts. That has specifically looked at the restatement and rejected it, although a concurring minority of the Massachusetts Supreme Court said that we should not reject reformation of wills in every case. And they cite even Scrivener's error as the type of case where reformation of a will could lie.
Well, let's accept that it's a good idea to allow reformation for the moment. Why shouldn't that be an idea for the legislature to consider, given the common law history and the entry into this field in some detail by the General Assembly in regulating what is a proper will and how to construe wills and trusts?
The legislature, I believe, has, by giving the Court of Chancery jurisdiction over essentially the entire Delaware Probate Code, has, in my opinion again, decided that the legislature knows the Court of Chancery is an equitable court and is going to be applying equitable principles. When it vests the Court of Chancery with jurisdiction over the probate code, I believe the legislature is giving a nod to the fact that the Court of Chancery is going to apply equitable principles as sort of gap fillers where statutes don't specifically speak to issues such as this. And my client takes the position that the statute of wills does not control the content of a will. All the statute of wills says is that this is what you need for a will to be valid. You need a writing signed by the testator and witnessed by two witnesses. Well, we have that in this case. We have a valid will. That doesn't go to content. Content is governed by general common law principles. And as Your Honor pointed out, since there is a progression of common law in this area of deciding that wills are not going to be subject to reformation.
Well, where's the progression? I find four states saying, no, we're not going to make that progress, and maybe two that have said yes.
Well, I mean, I think the progression is in the fact that the restatement, the drafters of the restatement, the American Law Institute, has determined that rather, and part of this analysis, we cite to a law review article from the University of Pennsylvania as well, some law professors there, they look at the fact that this reformation process has always sort of gone on behind the scenes, because what courts have done is they've looked at cases of where justice appears to not being done because of this rule that a will can't be reformed, and have, under the guise of construction or under the guise of other legal doctrines, sort of skirted around, done an end run around the rule that says you can never reform a will.
And would any of those apply here?
Well, I mean, in my opinion, the fact that the will states that the respondent is not supposed to take anything from the estate, that certainly creates a latent ambiguity in that document when you look at the fact that the respondent, if this will is not reformed, is going to get the overwhelming majority of this man's estate.
Mr. Miller, what I'd like to do is just try to understand exactly how the rule that you're arguing for would operate if we were to adopt it. Let's try out a few hypotheticals. Obviously, the perfect case, which assumes away the problem, is one where there is absolutely no dispute and no conceivable dispute about what the testator's intent was.
Correct.
And you know, in or proximate cause. you know, that the your claim is that's this case. So the rule could be that no reformation except in cases where there is no dispute, period. A different rule, a less strict rule, would be you can have reformation, but you have to prove intent by clear and convincing evidence. And the least strict rule would be preponderance of the evidence. But the difficulty with those latter two, and what makes wills different from commercial contracts, that is, disputes over commercial contracts that can be resolved using lesser evidentiary burdens, is that in the contract cases, you know, the both sides are there to testify about what their intent was. But that's not true, and it never will be true with the will.
Your Honor, it's also not true with the trust. Most trust cases, trusts have the same reason. People set up trusts for the same reason they have wills, to determine the disposition of assets after they're dead.
Okay, well, I'll accept that. But, and, you know, that may raise a question as to, you know, whether the trust rule makes sense given what the, you know, what the problem is that we're attempting to avoid or to solve. Let's keep the discussion confined to wills.
Well, I mean, I would urge the adoption of what the restatement drafters urge, which is the clear and convincing evidentiary standard. And that's entirely consistent with Delaware law, Your Honor.
Well, but the what that does is to import the risk that everyone appears to be concerned with, and that is that in the special case of wills, even a clear and convincing standard imports the risk of defeating the testator's intent, not implementing it.
Yes, but it does get you at least where you can determine that testator's intent, such as the case before the court, where the testator's intent is there's lots of evidence on one side of what it is and very little evidence on the other side. That clear and convincing evidence is at least going to put the plaintiffs to their proof and make sure.
You're using up your rebuttal time, but you're welcome to continue.
Well, I will continue just to make sure I've addressed Justice Jacobs' question as best I can, which is that a trial court, especially the Court of Chancery, is always going to be in the position of deciding where to draw the line. And if the line is going to be drawn on the quantity or the quality of evidence that's there, I believe the Court of Chancery is well suited to make that kind of decision. So imposing the higher evidentiary burden weeds out a lot of the cases in which people are just speculating about what the testator's intent is.
When you say consistent with Delaware law, we would have to overrule Miller versus Equitable Trust, wouldn't we?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I don't believe that court directly addressed whether or not reformation was available. That was argued as a construction case. It's hard to go back to 1943 and determine exactly what was argued, but from reading that opinion, I don't recall the court rejecting the concept of reformation. I recall it looking at that case, looking at the facts of that case as a will construction matter. So I don't believe that case would have to be directly overruled. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Justices. Richard Burrell for the appellee in this case. We in Delaware have been very fortunate to have been able to preserve this pure version of equity in our Court of Chancery. We have a clear body of law to rely on, most of which is based on hundreds of years of precedent, both in England and then in the United States. What that does in this court, or in this case, I think, is to crystallize the issue and make it very clear. And that issue is whether or not a will can be reformed.
Well, but before we hear a philosophical discussion about it, because I think the justices are well aware of the long tradition that you're referring to, would you agree that if this will is not reformed, that your client is going to receive a benefit that was not intended?
That's a very likely result, assuming the facts, as Justice Jacobs sort of discussed, you called it the perfect facts. I kind of called it the perfect storm from our perspective.
But and we actually have those facts here as opposed to it being a hypothetical, don't we?
Well, we have facts to an extent, Your Honor, because of the assumptions that are made vis-a-vis summary judgment cases.
All right. Well, then let's get right to it. Is there any evidence to support a finding that the will as written is a correct reflection of the testator's intent?
I don't believe there's any direct evidence of that, Your Honor.
Any indirect evidence?
Well, the inferences, for example, that Justice Jacobs referenced, the fact that the testator sat and listened to the explanation of the will, had an opportunity to review it, and then for 2.5 or so years or a year and a half following execution of the will didn't make any changes, it's possible that some inferences could be drawn. Also, the fact that sitting in that room by himself, he could have thought, well, I know that by not exercising the powers of appointment, my son's going to end up with this trust income.
Which is inconsistent with what the language of the will says, correct?
Well, unless you read the two together and imagine that perhaps what he was saying was, okay, I'm not giving him anything in my will because I know by not exercising the powers, he's going to inherit the trust fund. Those are inferences, and I understand that, and I can understand why the Vice Chancellor was a little troubled being boxed in.
Okay, well, so let's go back to the assumption that we're not dealing with a hypothetical. We're dealing with an actual case where there is no evidence of in support of your side, and that the result, if the will is not reformed, is that someone that the testator did not want to inherit is going to inherit a substantial portion of the total estate. Why doesn't that present a situation? Forget about all the other cases that might come down the road, but just let's look at this one. Why shouldn't we craft something that would allow the testator's intent to be fulfilled here?
That question, to some extent, Your Honor, assumes that this has never happened before, and I think that's incorrect. We know there have been numerous cases in the past where the court has simply not gotten into the background of the cases because the wills themselves were clear and unambiguous on the surface. This perfect storm that I referred to could have been an actual situation
times. Well, we have an ambiguity, if you want to look at it that way, because we have the will saying that this person gets nothing, and then the failure to appoint, which results in the same person getting a substantial amount. That could be argued to be an ambiguity. But forgetting the fact that there have been other cases where, I'd like to see which ones they are, but, you know, you're telling me there are other cases where there was a will that was omitted from it, and that there was no evidence but for the evidence that showed that was intended.
A couple of things to answer your questions, Your Honor. And the last part first, what I meant to say was that there could have been any number of cases like
this. But you don't know of it.
But I don't know specifically.
Fine. Okay, so we've got this case, one case, not all the parade of horribles or anything like that. We've got this case right here, where there's no contrary evidence. Why shouldn't the court system, be able to provide relief in accordance with the testator's intent?
Well, I think a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First of all is just the principle of equity that we've relied on and that the Vice Chancellor below relied on, that wills simply cannot be reformed. The second goes to the statutory aspect that I think Justice Ridgely may have touched on earlier. Any will that is subject to reformation will, by definition, not comply with the statute of wills or Section 202 of Title 12 of the Delaware Code. It will not have been signed by the testator and will not have been attested in the presence of the testator by multiple witnesses.
Well, that's based upon your interpretation of what a reformation involves. Doesn't the court, when it reforms an instrument, deem certain content to be in that instrument, and the instrument still exists, but it is now deemed, for example, when people won't sign a deed or whatever, it's deemed to have been signed, and it gets filed and recorded and has full effect. So why would you be violating the statute to reform this will?
Well, I think to some extent this goes back to the concept of reformation as Pomeroy described it and as Vice Chancellor Laster described it, where reformation was intended to be a two-part process, part one being the reformation itself and part two being a re-execution. Re-execution, obviously, in a situation of a will post-mortem is an impossibility. And then the second part of that is that under the statute, it simply cannot be re-executed and reattested after the fact.
But that's a fiction, isn't it? That is, any instrument which is reformed, you know, whether it's a contract, well, let's take contracts or anything else other than a will, the very judicial process of reformation obviates the need to have the parties get together and sign the contract as reformed. It's deemed to have been signed and executed with all of the hoops and curlicues as it was in the beginning, assuming that the reformed subject matter had originally been in the contract. And if that's true, why should a will be any different?
Well, I think you're correct to a great extent, probably to...
I just want to make sure I understand exactly where that your client's position... let me just go back and pose a couple of hypotheticals. Let's take the easiest one, or what I think is the easiest one, and that is that you have, you know, this case, Scrivener's error admitted, and all of the parties who would have any conceivable interest in the will agree that the client's intent, that is the testator's intent, was as expressed in the material that the scrivener left out. And they agree that the court can correct the will, that is, treat the will as though the left-out material had been inserted as it should have been. Your position in that circumstance, where no one, including your client, hypothetically, would object to a decree of reformation, there would be no problem. Would you agree with that?
That is the tougher of the three scenarios that you raised earlier.
Well, I thought it was the easiest because there's nobody complaining.
Well, depending on your.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's saying, yes, Judge, you're right, there was a mistake. We'll be happy to have you do it.
And my position on that, Your Honor, is simply that because of the history of equity and because of the statutes in effect at this point,
the answer is can't do it.
It cannot be done.
When there's a will, no way.
That has traditionally been the way that was perceived by equity.
Okay, so if everybody agrees to it, nobody objects, and your position is that it still can't happen in a court of equity, then I suppose that anything that does involve the slightest objection would fall by the wayside as well.
In the case of a reformation, that seems to be where the law goes. Now, I understand, and Mr. Miller reminds me of this frequently, that construction cases are different, and if there's an ambiguity that someone can show, then you can get into that extrinsic evidence.
The rule of no reformation is the rule of common law.
Correct.
A common law rule or a defense based on it can be waived. Would you agree?
I know the chancellor and the courts have...
That's a yes or no.
Well, keep
in mind that a constitutional right can be waived. So if that's true, why can't a rule of common law be waived?
Waiver by the parties, perhaps, but waiver by the court, I don't believe that's appropriate, Your Honor. The chancellor, I know, has the certain inherent ability to fashion... remedies, But the Shum case, I think it was, that was cited by the appellants in their brief, when I read that, there was an interesting quotation that talked about the ability of the chancellor to make modifications of new issues.
Well, is the principle that would preclude the chancellor from granting that relief when no one objects to it, and reformation relief is clearly within the range of remedies that equity is historically granted, What's the preclusion principle? Is it a principle of constitutional law? What is it?
Well, the principle is that equitable principle that simply says we don't reform wills. You can do it with trusts. You can do it with contracts. But we don't want to get in.
Pomeroy refer to lack of jurisdiction?
He was referring, I think, to the ability of the court to exercise jurisdiction over the decedent following death, Your Honor. That was the rationale for precluding a re-execution or a reformation of a will.
So if I understand you on this particular point, what you're saying in essence is that if everybody who had an interest in a will wanted to change it, then they could do so on their own in terms of whatever way they divide up the inheritance, but they couldn't do so through the court system and have the document actually reformed.
I think that's absolutely true, and I suspect that happens more frequently than perhaps we all realize. An effort to avoid litigation might result in all the parties agreeing that we'll read the will in a certain way to avoid all these problems.
So self-help to do what is just is okay, but having the court do what is just is not.
And I in the context of a case like this, I think that's absolutely true, Your Honor.
Any case.
Sure, you can settle anything, I guess, outside court on your own.
But the reason is not rooted in constitutional law. It's not rooted in a statute. It's rooted in some notion that whatever the reason was for not granting reformation in the first place, it was right, and we should stick to it.
It is a notion, obviously, that is passed down for centuries. So how it originally came to be, it's tough to say. But as I was listening to your questions of Mr. Miller, something popped into my mind. It's that analogous to a criminal situation in which some philosopher said, well, it's better to let nine guilty people go free than to put one innocent person in jail. And I think analogously, do we want to take the risk of making a mistake with one will by correcting nine others?
But if you want to follow that logic through, then in the so-called perfect case, the perfect storm, where even a beneficiary in the position of your client does not object to having the court reform the will, the only reason, that is the only sustainable reason or logical reason for the court not to do that would be, I guess, the possibility that even though all the beneficiaries, potential and actual, agree, that there's a risk that they're somehow colluding to present an untrue version of the facts to the court.
I think that's always a possibility. It's one of those cases that the Massachusetts Supreme Court was thinking of when it spoke of opening the floodgates of litigation if the reformation were extended to a will. I think that's always a possibility, hopefully not one that occurs terribly often, but it's, let's face it, there have been fraudulent cases brought before the courts before. One of the things you asked Justice Berger was about an action against the attorney, and that has been the white elephant, so to speak, in the room from the beginning. I think we all know that there is a potential remedy against the draftsperson in this case. It's not something we as lawyers enjoy speaking about terribly often. But what it does mean is that this is not a situation in which there is a party left with no remedy whatsoever. And that has been
Why isn't one of the remedies that given the disinheritance and then the absence of an appointment, that there's an ambiguity that can require or allow for extrinsic evidence?
The, the traditional definition of ambiguity is being able to read the document with more than two outcomes or two or more outcomes being reasonably possible, and I don't think that's possible reading this particular will. And I think that was what the master originally concluded, and I don't know that
even in the context of the extrinsic power of appointment.
Well, the only way that anybody would even know about that, Your Honor, would be by resorting to extrinsic evidence at the outset. And if you're looking at a document which is clear and unambiguous on its face, you wouldn't look at that. You wouldn't even know a power of appointment existed reading this particular will. And I think that's where the problem lies in terms of ambiguity. You can't read a power of appointment or a missed power of appointment into this will without first resorting to extrinsic evidence, and that's been impermissible in all the cases that we've looked at.
Mr. Burrell, just one last question. Assuming this matter would have gone to a full trial rather than being resolved in the procedural manner that it was, is there any, would the record be any different, you know, if your side had the opportunity to put on live witnesses?
I have a tough time answering that, Your Honor, because as the case progressed, the issue crystallized into this one issue, whether or not a will could be reformed. And at that point, frankly, the facts got put on a back burner. I don't know that there would be a whole lot extra that we would develop in terms of a factual background, but I would say that it simply has not, it was put on the back burner.
You can't rule it out.
I can't rule it out. One last thing that I did want to mention was the appellants have urged the adoption of this restatement. Justice Ridgeon, I think you characterized it properly. It's a decided minority view and remains that way. It remains also inconsistent with Delaware law in a number of important respects, one of which is in comment D when you read that it essentially eliminates the plain meaning rule. That is something which has been near and dear to the hearts of Delaware judges for many years, and in fact, Vice Chancellor Laster referred to Delaware as, quote, a plain-meaning state. And obviously, the court is familiar with the instances in which plain meaning is taken up in terms of interpretation of documents and statutes and that sort of thing. The restatement would essentially move away from that and essentially abolish the plain-meaning rule, at least in terms of interpretation of wills. It also suggests that there is some movement in any given state away from strict compliance with the formalities for execution of wills and codicils. And I don't believe that I've seen any evidence of movement in Delaware away from the strict requirements for the execution of those documents. And in fact, the Pilecki case from Vice Chancellor Strine a couple of years back kind of addressed that head on in terms of a codicil which had not been executed and which apparently was permissible at that point under New Jersey law, but which was being offered in Delaware. And he specifically said, you know, that may be what New Jersey does, but our legislature has certain requirements for the execution of wills and codicils, and if there's going to be any movement away from that, it's going to have to come from the legislature. And the last thing, also inconsistent in terms of the restatement, is the fact that it relies on unilateral mistakes as opposed to mutual mistakes. Reformation historically has been available in three very limited instances: fraud, which has never been an issue in this case, a unilateral mistake coupled by silence on the other side, or a mutual mistake. And we know from the cases in Delaware that...
But the difficulty is that a will is a unilateral document.
Correct.
And all of those rules that trigger reformation were derived from bilateral instrument cases.
And that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. In the one case, the petitioner or the appellant has cited the Roos case from back in 64, I believe it was. Vice Chancellor Short permitted that to go forward on a unilateral mistake. And I mention that simply because it doesn't run, it remains inconsistent with the traditional definition of reformation.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very, very briefly, Your Honors. The plain meaning rule, under traditional concepts of equity, a document is always, one can always present extrinsic evidence to prove mistake and fraud whether or not the document is clear on its face or not. So I don't really believe that an adoption of the restatement is throwing out the plain meaning rule in this state.
In other words, the fact that a document may have a plain meaning on its face doesn't preclude an action to undo that document or to reform it based on fraud.
That's correct, Your Honor, or mistake, as we're arguing in this case. Secondly, the Pilecki case, I believe, and the citations to the Delaware will statute only are, again, dealing with the validity of the document, and we're not talking about changing how to do a will, how to make a will a valid will in the state. That's not what we're asking the court to do. What we're asking the court to do is to apply the equitable concept, the equitable remedy of reformation, in order to do two things, which is adhere to the testator's intent in this case, and two, to prevent the unjust enrichment of the respondent. Unless the court has any other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your argument. The court will take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess. Please.